Jen, and welcome to Garden Planet. You're with Selena and Karen.
Afternoon, everyone.
And it is now well into 2020, guys, so I hope the new year's going well for you.
Hope you're relaxing in your hammocks.
By the beach.
By the sea.
Yeah, speaking of by the sea, that's actually our topic of the day.
Gardening by the sea.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking plants to plant if you are lucky enough to live by the sea. And also we're going to be talking about some plants that live in the sea or around the sea. I've got one specific. Anyway, we'll get into that. I'm not going to give it away.
Okay.
It's exciting. Selena's probably going to think completely off topic, but hey, what's new when Karen's in the studio? So welcome everyone. Hi to mine. Let's get started. So what, did you want to talk about some plants that you find in the sea waters?
Yes, well, I'm not a very good swimmer, Karen.
I remember that, dragging you in with my boogie board one day, yes.
I only go in up to my knees. But if you are wading out into the waters this summer, you might be tangled up in these plants. And what I have is the seaweeds that are growing in the sea.
Why do they call them seaweed? I know there's such a plant as seagrass. That's lovely.
Maybe there was no other name for it. Mm. Instead of sea plants, they just thought, oh, seaweed.
Yeah, I've never thought about it.
Well, there's sea cucumbers, but that's something completely different.
Yeah, that's an animal.
Seaweeds are plants that live in the sea. They are aquatic plants, and they are like algae. The plants, they don't have true stems, roots or leaves.
So what are they?
Oh.
A tentacle?
Well.
With chlorophyll?
I need to go investigate a bit more, but this is from what I found out. They do photosynthesize, so they are plants, which they're not fungi. Fungi don't photosynthesize, so that. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
And there are three main types of seaweed, according to the scientists. They have classified them into colours.
Oh, yeah.
So there are red ones called rhodophyta, brown ones called phaeophyta, and green ones called chlorophyta.
Okay, and they all contain chlorophyll. It's just
just the different colours.
Because chlorophyll is actually a green pigment, according to...
I would say they are like the ferns of the sea, and they need salt water and light to survive. So you won't find seaweed in the dark depths of the sea. They'll be on the surface and photosynthesising away and growing.
Yeah.
There's also, I found there were two main types within these colours. There's kelp, which is quite a common type of seaweed.
That's a brown?
Yep, they're browny coloured. They are really good nursery habitat for animals.
Oh, yeah. So they provide the smaller fish... Fishes, a little bit of shelter there from the currents and possibly other predators.
Yes, they grow on the rocks in the tidal areas. So
they grow on the rocks?
Yeah, they can cling to the rocks and then they just wave their fronds around. And there's also...
But not obviously with roots. They must have some other form of attaching.
They're little tentacle things. But there's free-floating ones, which I'm kind of not too sure would categorise as a plant. They are an algae. Plankton.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned plankton, because that was a part of my secret topic today.
Okay.
I've never thought about plankton, but it is such a critical component of our oceans.
It's amazing.
Is it? Oh, my gosh, we're on the same buzz here.
we're surfing through this. So what I found about plankton, which I thought was fascinating, is it captures carbon and it produces 90% of the world's oxygen. Amazing.
Really?
Yeah. So the sea, you think forests produce oxygen, but the sea is huge.
I would never...
The plankton.
I'm not a big sea lover myself. I love to swim, but I find being in the ocean's quite stressful. You know that. Like some people are totally at home in the waves, whereas I'm like, oh, and there's animals in there that I don't know about. And I burn easily and I can't be bothered with salt and sand in my hair. It's all a bit. But so to me, I'm more of a land dwelling type. But lately, I've had this strange fascination with the sea and the impact the oceans have on our whole globe.
Yeah.
And basically, if your ocean's sick or not doing well, the huge impact that has on the land. Apparently, it's really interlinked. And I've just, for some reason, I don't know what it is. And then you said, oh, I want to talk about sea plants. And I was like, oh, yay. I totally get you with it. And there's a book that I want to read called Seasick.
Oh.
And it's about the sciences and behind what I was just talking about.
Yeah.
So that is a little something for the readers. There's also a play that they made called Seasick this book.
But I've just looked that one up.
It really delves in, and this lady was the same as me. She said, oh, I had no idea. I'm not a scientist. I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. But now I'm absolutely, there's a lot to it.
Well, last year when the plastic bag ban came into effect, I was really thinking about how that all the plastic in the oceans are affecting all the animal life and marine life just all around.
Tiny
bits of plastic just in the water.
Yeah.
And the fish are eating it, the birds are eating it, swallowing it.
Yeah.
They're getting suffocated by these plastic bags.
We literally do not need plastic surgery. We're already full of it.
And in the North Pacific, there is actually a huge area that is just full of plastic. It's like a plastic soup.
Yeah.
Of all the plastic bags have been drifting into that sort of area.
Yeah.
It's like a huge dump and it's just terrible.
I mean, I know that over time it's amazing what you can pour into our vast ocean and it will over time, you know, sort of even out and like break down all those things. But it's just, I think it's just overwhelmed with human waste, isn't it, at the moment? It can't keep up, and that's the problem. And I'm very wary now whenever I buy anything plastic of where it's ending up because there's just too much. My son the other day wanted to buy, you know, you would because you work in a school.
Yeah.
Those little balloons like that, water balloons that you throw,
yes.
And they've got those things now where you put it on the end of the hose and it fills up like 100 at one time.
Yeah.
But it's all plastic. So I love water balloons and all that.
Yeah.
And I just think, Plastic.
Yeah.
Surely there's got to be a better way.
You don't need water balloons, people. You just can get your buckets and just chuck buckets of water.
Yeah, but each one of these balloons has got a little plastic attachment to it that self-ties it. So that's added on to that. What do you do? Why not? Why? It's all a convenience thing, isn't it? So we've
more
got
ways to use plastic and
just pull back on that a bit, for our sea life.
Okay.
I wonder how the sea plants are coping with it, because we hear about all the animals suffering.
Well, I think they can be our helpers. Just going back to seaweed, the properties of seaweed, we can use seaweed. There's so much of it in the oceans, if you know where to look. But a lot of us aren't aware of that it's a great food, that we can harvest it.
I think people are becoming more and more aware, though, don't you reckon?
Well, with sushi and miso and all those yummy
foods.
Yeah,
it seems to be more, like, if you'd said to me 20 years ago, here, eat some seaweed, I would have gone, you're joking. No, you know.
Yeah.
But now, oh, yum.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great tasty snack.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, the top producers of seaweed, the top countries, number one is China,
mm-hmm.
number two is France.
Or harvesters.
They'd
be harvesting it, not, I don't know
producing
if you can grow it. Can you?
and number three, which is really interesting, was the UK. So I was like quite surprised. There's no Japan, but China.
I wouldn't really want to have seaweed from around Japan anyway, just quietly after that whole Fukushima incident.
So maybe France, because they're the gourmet people and they just know.
I'm surprised the UK, if they're harvesting it from their waters, because I don't know if you've ever been to the UK.
Oh,
or a UK beach, yeah. But they're nothing spectacular, and they're cold. Seaweed, as you said, prefers warmer waters, but that's
obviously, you said
you won't find it but don't you know what you're saying?
Oh, they like sunlight.
Sunlight. I mean, so UK, I mean, I've lived there.
Oh, well.
There ain't much of that in winter, I'm telling you right now. You wake up in the dark, you get home from work, it's dark, it's light enough for the seaweed to, you know.
I'm going to have to investigate that number three.
It's just interesting. I'm sure it would grow, but just not.
Okay, yeah, good point.
I don't know.
Okay, so, yeah, seaweed is our sushi and then our miso soup, and also in seaweed there's jelly-like substance called agar, which is used in lots of foods like jelly and other
agar
purposes.
Plates
for scientists.
Did you study science at school?
Yes, I did.
Some people stay well clear of it.
I think it was compulsory.
Well, it should be, in my opinion. Yep. You've got to know this stuff. So agar plate. There you go. I never knew that agar came from seaweed.
No,
and
I've
smeared a lot of agar plates in my time.
Well, if you think about the seaweed in the water, it kind of swells up, has this jelly-like.
It does, goo in it. Yeah, yeah.
And it's very good for growing. What do they grow in agar? Do you recall?
We use it to grow all sorts of microorganisms to see what would happen. You know, you go and swab the classroom toilets or whatever and go and swab your agar plate and see what grew on it. It's the perfect substrate for growing microorganisms. That's why they use it. So there must be something there. It must be full of nutrients.
It is, which brings me to my next point. So seaweed can be used in medicine because it's so nutritious.
Mm.
And kelp is one of the best sources of iodine. For many people, they are short of iodine, especially if they live in a landlocked area far away from the sea. They don't get that nutrient. And so what the salt people have done is iodised their salt so they can get that essential element in there.
Iodine is also being, I don't know if you discovered this, but it's being the market's being totally, well, I don't know if swamped, but a lot of people are, especially the Asians, are grabbing it by the bucket load because it has properties in it that help with radiation sickness. So in Japan, where they've had this Fukushima incident meltdown, a lot of people are buying iodine pills because it's got some sort of property in it that
helps
radiation illnesses.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was interesting. And isn't that interesting? So I'm going, at the same time, I don't know if I want to eat seaweed from around that area, but then if it naturally contains iodine,
it's a rongoa. That's a plant that will help us.
Yes.
And it's around us. So the most important for us gardeners is that the seaweed is a excellent fertilizer.
Yes,
and
it is.
Mulch. It's so nutrient dense. It has all these minerals that the plants just love. Mm. And if you use it as a mulch or a fertilizer, you can break it down and chop it up and put
it's
some
recommended, I don't know if you're going to say this, probably, to soak it for a day first. Reason being, you want to get all that excess salt.
Sometimes I don't know if the salt is not very harmful.
I think that's if you're growing baby plants.
Okay, yep.
More.
Yeah.
But, a bit of salt in the soil is great for the structure.
Yeah.
Soil structure.
So excellent for your plants, and they'll love you for it. aside from the fish heads and things, but
yeah,
the seaweed is a natural mulch for your plants.
Yes.
And the sea grass type seaweed is very good. And
is that a particularly
good? It looks kind of like shredded paper. But
I know. Yeah. I saw some just the other day up at the Triangle Road Community Garden.
Did you grab some?
I went to, and then the lady there, is it Linda, stopped me and said, no more grabbing of the seagrass.
Oh.
So, just as an aside there, don't grab anything from the pile of seagrass. No, heaps of people word got round and then everyone was, like, grabbing.
I thought it was.
But, interesting fact, I don't know if I should be saying, I'm going to, they get it from St. Heliers, which is an eastern beach in Auckland for those people not from Auckland listening.
Yeah.
And there's a guy that goes around with his tractor. He gets paid to do this by the council to scoop up all this seagrass from the beach because St. Heliers is like a more
salubrious area.
That's a great word. Yes, wealthy area, and they want the beaches nice and clean.
Oh, with
so
nice seaweed.
That's how we've. So if you Google, I don't know, St. Heliers seaweed cleanup, you could probably get some dropped off. He just drops it off for free.
Karen, I think we've cottoned on to why it's called seaweed, because the beaches, they want to clear it.
That's right. It's in the wrong place. Oh, Selena, the penny has dropped.
Why didn't we think of that before?
Hmm.
They want a nice clean beach and no weeds on it, so they've got to get rid of the
mystery
seaweed.
Mystery solved. Yeah.
Two more things. Mm-hmm. Great soil improver, so it really helps with your soil. Mm-hmm. Now, touching on the edible part of our seaweed, the Māori people will call this type of seaweed karingo.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, it is a great snack, and apparently the Māori battalion used to eat it on their, tour of duties. It was just a great superfood for them.
So they've been consuming it for a long time.
Yeah.
They
knew it was great
good
for them. Yeah.
Or maybe they just like the taste.
Maybe. But
and felt well.
It was a great snack, so they could just take it with them.
Yeah, it's yummy. I mean, because I like salty foods, but I don't want to always eat crisps.
Yes.
And I've noticed in my household, Pierre, he's a big crisp eater. I've started feeding him those seaweed snacks, and he's really into it because it gives him that salty sort of bang.
Yeah.
But it's not like a big heavy crisp, and it's quite, and I wonder if it's naturally salty. They probably wouldn't need to salt it.
Not really, no.
Yeah, so it is a yummy snack.
Yeah, and I think you can, how they get it crispy is they don't even need to fry it in heaps of oil like you do with potato chips. I think you just dehydrate
it. Wonderful snack.
And grill
it. So healthy.
And it just comes out all crispy.
Yeah.
So that's something for us gardeners to consider.
Definitely. So was there anything else you wanted to?
No, that's
okay.
All that
I have. I'm going to go off on my aside here.
It's swimming.
Okay. So coral.
Yes.
Yes. I'm going to ask you a question. Is it a plant or is it an animal, Selena?
I think it might be a bit of both.
That's a good answer.
I'm just on the fence now.
Okay. Or maybe on the reef.
Yes.
The Greek philosopher Aristotle's pupil, Theophrastus, described the red coral as corallian, implying it was a mineral. But he also described it as a deep sea plant, where he mentions large stony plants that reveal bright flowers when underwater in the Gulf of Heroes. So that was the first thoughts on coral. Mm-hmm. Bit of history there. Pliny the Elder stated boldly, I suspect that's a famous scientist back in the day, stated boldly that coral are neither animals nor plants, but are possessed of a third nature. So that was his opinion.
Yes.
So, okay, you could be onto something. So it was believed that corals were plants until famous astronomer William Herschel used a microscope to establish that coral had the characteristic thin cell membranes of an animal. So it is an animal. However, but it looks like a plant. But I really wanted to mention this because I'm going to read some information that I got. Because it relates to our topic of plankton. Corals feed on plankton.
Okay. I see, yep.
And plankton is a diverse group of organisms, including bacteria, algae, protists, and even floating animals. So you could get a floating jellyfish in amongst there. It's just big pockets of floating stuff, basically. Certain animals just basically just open up their mouths and just filter on
it. As long as there's no plastic.
I'm sure there won't be. I mean, you're guaranteed these days, aren't you, of the bonus plastic beads in there. A group of coral called the zooxanthellae is able to supplement their plankton diet via a type of protist. A protist is a single-cell organism, by the way, called dinoflagellate. This single-cell organism called dinoflagellate is found in the coral's tissues. And coral is made up of polyps. If you look closely, do you know what a polyp is?
You might need to explain that
one. A sac-like animal, okay, typically only a few millimetres in diameter and a few centimetres in length, okay? And then it's got a little set of tentacles around a central mouth opening. That's what coral is. But apparently this coral that I'm talking, quite a large group called the, I'm not even, that one, 30% of these polyps is made up of these dinoflagellates. Now, where does this come into the plant world? Well, dinoflagellates often live in symbiosis with marine invertebrates, including coral and jellyfish. Okay. They're a symbiote, I think they call them. This single-celled organism has its distinctive swimming style and contains chlorophyll. So this is where
the plant
starts assimilating with the plant world a bit. There are only a select number of organisms that contain chlorophyll, including green plants, which is probably why so much of the ocean produces oxygen, because there's so much of these. I'll get into that. Next one, prokaryotic blue-green algae.
Yes.
Eukaryotic algae. Okay, so these are the ones that were 90% of the world's oxygen, and that is why, because they contain chlorophyll, which is an essential component of the photosynthesis. What do you call it? Reaction.
Yeah.
Reaction. And, of course, the green slug and the green sea slug.
The green slug?
They also contain chlorophyll.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Genetic masterpiece or genetic mutation, I don't know, it's starting to get a bit, sounds like a bit
freaky.
Of a thriller movie.
Giant slugs of the sea.
Well, I mean, I watch all these crazy movies with my son, who's a youngster, and I think, all these mutations that are coming, it sounds a bit like, anyway. So during the day, these dinoflagellates, these single-cell things that are found in, with the chlorophyll, provide their host with organic carbon products of photosynthesis, glucose, glycerol, amino acids, at times providing up to 90% of their host's energy needs. There's 90% coming in again. I didn't even know that you'd mention that, you were going to mention that. And in return, they receive nutrients like carbon dioxide in an elevated position to access sunshine. Interestingly, when coral is stressed by changes in conditions such as temperature, light, nutrients or pollutants, this sort of brings us into the destruction of the coral reef, they expel these protists, causing them to turn completely white. That's the coral. It's referred to as coral bleaching.
So
that happens when they expel these. Well, they do that when they're under stress, because then these protists
can reproduce.
They are absorbing too much from them, and they're stressed out, so they basically expel them out their feeding hole. Interesting, isn't it?
Amazing.
Coral. Yeah. So anyway, I had to do it, Selena. Selena said to me, don't you go off too far aside on the topic, and I said, oh, I will.
Okay.
But it's very interesting though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Chlorophyll and the link to the ocean. Yeah. Fascinating. So, moving away from the ocean, should we talk about what to plant beside the ocean if you're lucky enough to? Since we said we were going to.
Well, of course.
And we've only got 6 minutes, so we better get on to it.
Okay. What are we planting by the sea?
Well, I mean, my favourite is Pohutukawa.
Yep, top of my list.
Wonderful plant. If I was lucky enough to have a batch on the ocean, I'd definitely plant that for several reasons. It's beautiful. Holds to the soil well, sandy soils. I've seen them, literally their roots dangling.
They love the beach.
And they're a great way of filtering. The one thing have you ever stayed at a batch and the sand literally like was blowing in through the door? I've been there when that's happened and there's literally sand just blowing into the house. I feel like if you've got a good, strong bunch of trees there, that can kind of filter that a bit and provide a bit of a barrier, that would be a big recommendation for me.
Yep.
First thing. Any other suggestions on that?
Okay, maybe not trees. I have a few. Shrubs, hibiscus is a lovely one by the sea.
Yeah.
Just gives you that tropical vibe.
Yeah, and it can handle it.
It can handle it. One that I thought, why, but I'm just going to say it. Agapanthus.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've always wondered what the heck to do with agapanthus. We saw some for sale at
King's
the other day. I was like, what?
Why? Sell it. Well, they sell the tiny ones, not the big ones.
But that is why. If you are living on... What a great use for a plant that takes over.
Yeah.
That's a plant you'd want taking over if you lived right on the... Yep. Post.
Good for erosion control, so they'll just cling to anything. Very hard to kill.
Oh, they do.
And they're quite just happy, you know, in a beach setting.
Yeah, well, they're happy anywhere, really.
But you don't need to really look after them. They're just happy doing
I know. Anything. So great carefree kind of gardening there. I like the old Norfolk pine. I love a pine. I always seem to come back to my pines.
Yes, you like your pines.
Like Norfolk pines?
But they're very, very tall, so you've got to make room for them.
Yeah. I guess I'm getting a bit adventurous with my batch here. I'm thinking like cliffside.
Your batch.
And you've got to be careful if it's too close to the batch. You don't want it falling over onto you. Beautiful.
Protea, I don't know if you know that one.
I did come across that.
Yeah. It seems to be quite happy by the sea.
That's the South African plant?
Yes, a lot of South African plants are happy by the sea.
Very
hardy and colourful as well.
And give them time.
Yeah.
My mum's got a few growing in her garden and I said, I want some of those. She said, I don't think I've got the patience, that's me, to grow. They just give them a bit of time to settle in and then once they're settled, boom, beautiful.
One that everyone can grow is sunflower.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because the sun's around. Yeah.
It can handle the sand and salt?
It can.
Yeah? What about the wind?
Oh, not so much. You might want to go for daylilies if it's a bit more windy.
Rosemary, lavender.
Yep. Oh, yes.
Cistus.
Echium.
Yeah.
And gazanias. Gazanias are very good.
Okay. And another shrub is the Adenandra.
Oh, I haven't heard of that one. I've got Bird of Paradise. That's a very tough plant.
Oh, yes.
Amazing.
And, so there's some suggestions there for you guys.
One more.
Tell us.
The aloe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And the bougainvillea.
And the canna lily.
And the pyrostegia and ivy.
And the
Another one that no one wants, but you would want it by your seaside batch.
And don't forget to stick in a few cabbage trees and then stick a hammock in between.
Oh, of course.
You have to.
Yeah. So you can admire your garden from your hammock. All right, guys, we're out of time once again.
All right, so you've got to be happy beside the sea.
Yeah, 'tis the season.
So just relax and chill out and happy gardening.
And listen to our podcast if you've got time. See you all.
All right. Bye for now. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. That's all we have time for. Come back next week for more great gardening tips at Garden Planet. You can find us on Facebook on our Garden Planet Facebook page or email us at gardenplanetfm@gmail.com if you want to ask us anything about gardening. Happy gardening, everyone, and we'll be back next week. Listen on planetaudio.org.